the reason these disturbances, they followed you to a new home, is because it's not the house that's haunted. It's your son.
So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
You get another beer, you want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit. Oh.
My name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. You found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do.
California, stay away from it. Stay away from it. I'll come in here. John Doe has the upper hand.
And on that day, Ahab will go to his grave, but he'll rise again within the hour. He will rise and beckon that all save one shall follow.
They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you!
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am well.
And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Doing all right. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Excellent. We usually have another co-host, Abe from Massachusetts, but he just disappeared off the face of the earth, hasn't contacted any of us, and we have no idea where he is.
He should have left. He's in that house. The house got him.
Maybe so. It was very bizarre, though. He usually texts. He usually texts or instant messages us on Facebook.
Yeah, Ray's got him. Okay. Yeah, I hope he's okay.
He's being anally probed.
Oh,
it's possible.
Thank you for the image I really didn't need, Eric.
Oh, my God. All right. So for folks who are new to our podcast, we are, as stated, Dark Discussions Podcast. You can find us at darkdiscussions.com, where we just rebooted the network from a handful of podcasts to a network of podcasts plus articles. Basically, you can go there and find all our podcasts that any of our co-hosts are on, as well as fellow podcasters who have their shows on the site. Basically, we discuss intelligently a genre that deserves intelligence, and those genres are horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, grindhouse, art house, midnight movies, cult films, and even foreign films and such. So genre films and art house films and all that good stuff. We also have a Facebook group called Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, and we also have a Twitter account, Dark Discussion 1, and you can email us at darkdiscussions@aol.com, darkdiscussions@aol.com, or just go to the website, darkdiscussions.com, and press the contact us choice, and that basically does the same thing as the email. Eric, what else can people find?
Oh, I don't know. The new website confuses and frightens me. I don't know exactly what everything is and where it is, but I do know that one thing you can find on there is a link to our Patreon account. Patreon is a service that allows you to financially support your online artists like us. Producing this show is not free. We have to pay for things like the website and running movies and equipment and so on and so forth. So if you would like to help us offset those costs, that's how you can do it. Go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. For every $5 a month that you care to donate, you will have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly do a show about. We take all the submissions from our patrons and once a quarter draw one at random to do a show about. So if you'd like to do that, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com.
Excellent, excellent, and greatly appreciated, because just a couple of weeks ago we released Mothman Prophecies, which was a patronic pick by one of our listeners out of Canada, Chris Genro, and we actually got a lot of feedback on that episode. It appears that Mothman is a very well-liked film. I call it classic in a sense. Let me read these emails here, quick ones. We got one from Amy Rain, who's a fellow podcaster and actually on the Dark Discussions Network. She does Fishnets and Phantoms podcast, and this is what she has to say. She says, "Hey, all, great episode. Oh my God, that phone call. We both got so scared from that. I didn't know if it got anyone else, so I'm glad it got you all too. Oh, and my last name is pronounced like Rain." All right, so I think I got that right. "I also like the idea that the Mothman isn't either helpful or harmful. It makes me think of fairy lore pointing out that they don't care about the same things we do. There are warnings that if you want to dabble in the supernatural, to be careful not to try to contact them because you don't know how it will act. Perhaps the phenomenon is connected to fey lore. Hope you all are safe and well, Amy." So thank you there. And yeah, that's a fair point, right? I mean, the fey and all that stuff, which means like fairies and dwarves and all that stuff, are folklore and mythical beings, and the Mothman is kind of sort of that way, I think. And that's a fair point.
I do not know enough about the fey to comment.
Yeah, I used to read a lot of Arthur Machen, who's a contemporary of Lovecraft, a couple of years before, English author, and Lovecraft always wrote about him, saying he was one of the best. And he always wrote about, had horror stories of these type of creatures, where he took folklore creatures like gnomes and fairies and all that, and they were actually evil, and they were the monsters that he kind of uses in his stories, with where they were pretty pretty intense. His most famous is The Great God Pan, which is one of the best horror stories I've ever read. It makes sense. And the Mothman is kind of sort of like that, and how she said it's neither good or bad. It's almost like an outer being in Lovecraft, where humans are like insignificant. And then we got Dustin Watson, a podcaster of the Watsy Party podcast.
I got thrown for a second because it's been so long since I heard anybody say his first name.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay, all right. Dustin Watson, out of Washington State, I believe. This is what he has to say. He goes, "I thoroughly enjoyed your recent episode on the Mothman Prophecies. I remember taking my little sister to see it at the theater when I was a teenager. In fact, she and I were the reason our then brand new local cinema house even screened the film. Basically, we had relentlessly called the theater's phone in suggestion box and couldn't have been more surprised that they actually started playing it. If you care to know, we repeatedly suggested that they should play the Chapstick movie as well. LOL. It was there for 1 week only, with only one showtime each night. Anyway, I've always found this film's subtle psychological approach to the horror effective. The way the red lights placed throughout remind the viewer that the Mothman is everywhere, that all around us the inexplicable exists whether we know it or not. It knows us, and that's terrifying. I particularly applaud the story's handling of the idea that we can never truly comprehend the mechanisms of the otherworldly. Beings of that nature may well interact with us, but we can't ever know them or their motivations in any real fashion. Ever since seeing this movie, I've been fully fascinated by the statement the character of Alexander Leake makes to Richard Gere, and I mentioned this one when we did the episode too. I thought it was remarkable. He continues. He says, if there was a car crash 10 blocks away, that window washer up there could probably see it. Now, that doesn't mean he's God or even smarter than we are, but from where he's sitting, he can see a little further down the road. Brilliantly put. My friends, you all tackled the above points really well, and I was entertained as all hell by your episode on this movie. Keep up the great work. Much love, Watson.
Thanks, Watson.
That was really nice. Thank you.
Very cool.
Yeah. And then we have one more, and this one is from Chris Jenner himself. And I have to find it. This new Facebook is so confusing.
Yeah, I have trouble finding things, too. It's annoying, and I find that it loads more slowly.
Yeah, yeah. But I did find it. Here we go. All right, here we go. So Chris Jenner. And he says some very nice words to you, specifically, Christy. But this is what he says. Mm-hmm. Thank you, guys, Philip, Eric, Michael, and Christy, for such an in-depth and fascinating discussion and dissection of one of my favorite films. I was so happy Christy Schoonover was involved, as I just knew it would be a huge favorite of hers, and she would provide some great insight. She always... a treasure trove of information with all the research she puts into each episode. Also, I must now watch Dark Waters, the film that Phil mentioned with Mark Ruffalo starring. That sounds interesting. Also, just need to correct Christy on one thing. Mark Pellington, the director, yes, was predominantly known for music videos, but had directed one feature film before Mothman Prophecies, which was the highly regarded Arlington Road with Jeff Bridges and Tim Robbins.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I didn't know that. That's awesome.
Yeah, so
I'll have to check that out then, because I know Charles, my housemate, was interested in seeing more by this particular guy, so we'll definitely have to check it out.
Yep. Absolutely. All right. Sounds good. So that's our emails for tonight. We do have some Lovecraft emails, but we'll save those for the Lovecraft County podcast, that country podcast that me and Mike do
this
week. Yes.
What's today?
Today for Pam, one of our listeners who always wants to know the days, is 9/17/2020, or one day after Mexico Independence Day.
Do you know what else today is?
The day before tomorrow. Thursday.
Today is the birthday of one Cassandra Peterson.
Oh, okay.
Who, of course, is better known as
Elvira. Yeah.
Elvira, who I had 30 minutes with, and she said I was amazing.
And you'll bring it up as many times as you possibly can.
Bring it up as many times as I can. And you know how old she is today?
No.
I'll say 67.
No. Little older.
71.
A little younger.
69.
She's 69 today. Happy birthday, Elvira.
Damn, and she looks so amazing.
She does.
Yes, she really does. And no house was amazing? I am, because she said so.
Oh, shut up.
Right. And what else is it, Eric, today that was of note?
I don't know.
Oh, you just wanted me to bring that up for Pam?
Yes.
Gotcha. Excellent. And for all our friends and neighbors in this great nation of Mexico, happy Independence Day.
Oh, God. Sorry.
All right. Oh, and listeners from Mexico, too.
Starting to crack under the pressure. The other day, I'm in school, and I just lost it because I looked. There was a sign hanging up that was, like, I guess the drama club had put up in the spring. It was a motivational poster. It said, "This is your year."
Maybe not.
Boy, did that take on a completely different meaning now. That's just...
Yeah. Technically, generally... even though all the stuff outside is kind of sucking, the year has been pretty solid. I mean, I've been pretty happy generally as a human being. So I can't complain that way. But yeah, all the stuff outside and the COVIDs and all that kind of sucks.
Holy, other people are horrible.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure how other people's mental health is, to be honest. I can't speak for them.
And I got an email from AMC Theaters telling me that my $10 bonus bucks are about to expire. I should use them soon.
Oh, I had to do that with Buffalo Wild Wings.
Of course, I live in New York where none of their theaters are open.
I had to do that with Buffalo Wild Wings in April, and that was before anybody would want to eat in restaurants. So I had to buy like 12 bottles of sauces with my
points. Right, well, you could do there. You could do takeout. They don't exactly let me go in and bring home Tenet
movies.
Yeah, that's true, Mike. Well, you could use it to take out, buy popcorn, and bring it home with it.
Yeah, maybe. But the theaters aren't open. They're not just sitting there selling popcorn and not letting you into the theater.
Oh, well, theaters are open here in New Hampshire.
And not in New York. That's my point. They're still closed in New York.
Talking about a movie.
This is movies.
Anyway. All right. So let's move along and get into our topic tonight. Eric, what do we got for tonight?
Tonight, we're going to be talking about a 2020 release starring Kevin Bacon and Amanda Seyfried called You Should Have Left.
Amanda Seyfried.
I'll settle down.
Anyway,
You sure you're not the one who recommended this? Because that totally felt like a Phil recommend when I saw Amanda Seyfried was in it.
Yeah, she's one of my favorites, that's for sure.
Actually, but though, it was me.
It was Chrissy.
It was me. Because Phil messaged me and asked what I had seen recently from 2020 that I really liked. And I had seen like two or three things that were shit, but this was not shit. And the host I liked too, but I didn't think host was enough for us to really talk about. It's fun, but there's not a whole lot going on. So I recommended this one.
Come away with me. If I don't get out of here for a while, I'm going to go nuts.
I love you so much.
It's just the three of us, just you and me and Ella.
Daddy, because you're old, you'll die before mommy, right?
Hey. Not that old.
It's so beautiful!
Wow.
I love this.
Wait.
What?
Listen. Be quiet. Hey.
There was a shadow on the wall.
I know it's fun, but it's time to sleep. Good night, honey. Jesus, you got enough switches? Does this wall look right to you?
What are you doing?
26 feet. 21. This room. It's 5 feet longer on the inside than it is on the outside.
How does that work?
It doesn't.
Anything happened yet?
Ella! Ella!
You chose this place, not me.
You sent me the link.
I absolutely did not. You sent it to me. Somebody wrote in my journal. Do you like it here?
No. Do you?
I hate it.
Before that one.
What sort of house?
Why do people hate Daddy so much?
The judge and the jury all found him innocent, but some people didn't believe him.
The house chose me.
He must be guilty of something.
People have always stayed in that house.
Ella!
Some don't leave.
Wake up! It's a dream!
The right ones usually find the place. Maybe it's the other way around. The place finds them.
Yep, so Chrissy recommended it. And I had already seen it. I saw it a couple, like, the first week it became rental available, because prior to that it was only the $20 rentals, and then it went down to normal. But either way, You Should Have Left, directed by David Cope, one of the highest grossing screenwriters in the history of movie cinema. He directed this film. He also has directed other films with Kevin Bacon, including Stir of Echoes. He wrote a screenplay for this based off of the novel You Should Have Left by Daniel Kalman. It's a German novel originally, I believe. The film was originally supposed to be a big release for the spring at theaters, but of course, due to COVID, Universal decided to go the route that Trolls World Tour and Scoob did, and released it straight to VOD for the big expensive $20-$25 rental. And then the film eventually, like all those films, became normal priced. Film was only a $4 million budget, and as Eric mentioned, Kevin Bacon and Amanda Seyfried were the stars. It takes place mostly in the UK. Critical response actually has been growing. Originally, when it first came out, it was in the low 30s, but within the past month, when more people have seen it that are qualified for Rotten Tomatoes, it's gone up 9% since then to 40%, which is decent for a horror film, generally, because horror films usually get around 50% unless they transform over and above for everybody. And that's pretty much all I got here. So I guess we can discuss how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. So, Chrissy, since you chose it, why don't you begin?
I rented this a couple of weeks ago because my sister, I know that you guys had mentioned it to me at one point, or Phil, you had, and said it was pretty good. But my sister had seen it and just raved about it and said, I really think that this movie's up your alley. I really think you're going to enjoy it. And so one day, Nathan, Charles, and I just sat there on a weekend afternoon and rented it. I really thought it was excellent. I think the script is tight. I really like the atmosphere. I love the idea that this house has a little bit of an urban legend connected to it, but that it is very subtly meted out. I thought the acting was really great. I thought Kevin Bacon did a great job. He looks appropriately weary and beleaguered and weighed down by his own guilt, which I honestly think it takes a pretty good actor to pull it off. It's not just makeup. It's a certain thing in the stature that you have to get. And I really think he did an excellent job with that. I liked that there was a lot of depth about this movie. It did have things to say, things about secrets, things about lost innocence, things about redemption, things about guilt. So in short, this movie was exactly right up my alley. I rented it again this evening so I could watch it a second time. And knowing kind of what the twists and turns were, it's actually more interesting on the second watch because you have a chance to catch more subtle things that you kind of missed the first time. So I very much enjoyed this. It's a high recommend for me. And I think my favorite thing about it is that it's a haunted house story with a twist. For me, that's kind of how I would describe it to people.
All right.
So
very
those
good.
Are my thoughts.
Yep. Very good. Very good. So just one other thing. So this is also a co-produced, obviously, with the Blumhouse, who has that deal with Universal anyway. So this is a Blumhouse film. And for folks who are interested in David Cope, the highest grossing, one of the top 10 highest grossing screenwriters of all time. He wrote films like Jurassic Park, Mission Impossible, Spider-Man, and such. All right, Eric, what do you got?
Well, I noticed this when I was scrolling through back in the spring with the outrageous $19.99 rental price. I was like, well, nope, not paying that, but I'll probably get around to it eventually. This movie was fine. It didn't thrill me all that much, but I didn't think it was bad either. There's a girl in the movie, and I'm not trying to be mean to a little girl. I know casting children is difficult, but I didn't care for her. I didn't care for her a great deal. And I also thought that some of the relationship stuff between Amanda Seyfried and Kevin Bacon was really just filler to extend the runtime and didn't need to be there. But I did like some of the more mind-bendy stuff that was in this movie. And I like, I don't know. There was a reveal that once they revealed it, I was like, well, yeah, but we kind of knew, and it wasn't really that. And I don't know. It was just kind of anticlimactic. So I thought it was decent, but not great. Certainly not bad. Critics were a little harsh to this movie when it came out, and I don't think it quite deserved that. But I'm not going to tell you to rush out and purchase it either. Maybe wait for a streaming service or something. So I would give a lukewarm recommend.
All right, very good. For me, I heard about it similar to Eric. Anything that Kevin Bacon pops up in is a curiosity for me because I've always liked Kevin Bacon and his work.
Bacon.
Yes, and he has a great last name. And anything with Amanda Seyfried, that made me almost want to rent it for $20, but I held off.
You're so
sad. pretty eyes do that to me sometimes. I thought the movie was really good. My wife actually liked it a lot, too. She actually chose it. And I actually kind of like the relationship between Seyfried and Bacon because I, after reading a bunch of reviews after watching the film to see what they had to say, because you mentioned, interestingly, Eric, that some critics were harsh. And a lot of them focused on how they thought the relationship was one of the interesting parts of the film, which I have to agree with, because it's basically an older man that has a young wife, and it talks about his virility. You know, it's kind of symbolism of his virility. Is he losing his? You know, he's losing what he was when he was 30, and they talk a lot about it. I know, Chris, you're going to have a lot to say about that relationship because I think you probably know what I'm talking about when so we'll talk about that after.
Well, my complaint with the film isn't that it was uninteresting in and of itself, is that it was irrelevant to everything else.
Interesting. All right.
That's
all. Sure. All right. We'll discuss as we get in. I actually really liked it. I mean, I'm still confused why a lot of critics didn't like it. For some reason, it's just interesting. But I would recommend it. Thumbs up. Mike.
I'm probably going to be the biggest thumb down, I think, on the group, not like Gallo's thumb down. There's two issues here for me. And one is completely me. Actually, they're both very much me. Honestly, I came into this exhausted last night. It was about the only time I had to squeeze in a 2-hour time for a film. And I had a really hard time just staying awake through the movie. And I know I drifted off at one point, and then when I woke up to see what I missed, it turned out it was nothing. And that was part of the problem. And then it's also just not a type of film that is up my alley, because it is a lot of this sort of fever dream stuff that it just doesn't sell well with me or doesn't play well with me. But it's also a thing where I kind of saw where it was going really early on. And maybe that is a product of just being a veteran of these types of films, but I suspect I could have seen where this was coming. Where this was going, kind of going, you know, maybe when I was like 12 too. So, because there is a big reveal at the end, I won't say that now because we're not in spoiler territory. But I kind of saw that big reveal coming.
Yeah.
And I thought it was. I'm not saying I'm a brilliant detective. I'm just saying I thought it was really obvious. And you know, it's like when that friend of yours comes out and says they're gay, and everyone's like, "Yeah, we know." You know. When did you figure it out? So that made it very anticlimactic. I will agree, like, with all the positive stuff Chrissy said, I will agree with. I think, you know, the direction was fine. The acting was really solid. I actually did find the relationship kind of interesting. There was stuff in there that I was kind of hoping. I was like hanging on there, trying to hang on to the film. And to me, it just didn't really pan out. And I will disagree with Eric. I really liked the little girl because I thought she very plausibly felt like whatever she was, like a 6-year-old girl. You know, she was this little hyperactive bundle of energy doing whatever the hell she wanted. And the parents are constantly like, no, stop doing that. No, get off. Come down. Stop. Get off this in the kitchen. Don't do that. And then she knocks something over and she's crying. Yes, she's annoying, but she's a little girl. She's supposed to be hyperactive and annoying. And I thought she did a really good job of playing exactly what it was that she was, which many little kids can't do naturally. But she did it adorably, right? So you also understood why her parents didn't beat her. Because that's part of the reason kids are supposed to be cute. But yeah, so I like that. There are elements I liked. And so I'm not going to say, and I'm also, again, my exhaustion could very well be coloring it. And the fact that this is not a film that is in my normal wheelhouse, that could have been amplifying it. So it is going to be a thumbs down. It is not a massive thumbs down, but it is also a thumbs down in that it is thumbs down for me. I think there is enough there that if you have any interest in the concept, if you have any interest in Kevin Bacon, or Amanda Seyfried,
David Cope,
or whales, then you know maybe you want to watch the film.
Whales.
So I would agree with Eric in his final conclusion, which is Netflix it, Shudder it, whatever it is, or Amazon Prime it when it is free to stream. That would probably be my recommendation because let's be honest. Neither Kevin Bacon nor Amanda Seyfried nor David Cope are really hurting for the money. So, no, it's done fine. Was it? What did you say it would cost, Phil?
$4 million. Yeah,
$4 million. It's made its money back. They rented it 3 times, and there you go. You know, back when it got for because that exorbitant original rental price. So, and they made their money back. So they'll be fine. So I would go with this. Go with the free option when you can.
All right, very well.
And by the way, Phil, I think this now means we're just down to Friday the 13th and Hollow Man is the only Kevin Bacon films that we have not reviewed in this podcast that are horror adjacent.
Maybe, yeah. I'd have to look through his filmography, yeah.
Because we've done Tremors, right?
Yep.
We did
Stir of Echoes.
Stir of Echoes. We did, what was it, The Darkness?
I still haven't watched that one.
I'm not familiar.
No, I thought we did do that.
I don't recall you guys ever doing that episode.
Wait, what is that?
Oh my God, Abe is here.
Yes, from the further, from the void, it is I.
I thought you were dead.
No, just maybe dead time from work, but I'm alive. Right.
Who had Abe is alive in the pool?
Not me.
Who gets the money?
All right. Well, anyway, let's move on. So Abe is here from Massachusetts. How did you hear about this film and your thoughts?
I heard about this film because I saw in the chat that this was going to be our next topic, and considering that this is the most recent Kevin Bacon film, that was one of the things that kind of interested me because, you know, as they say, everything's almost better than bacon. And, you know, Kevin is that kind of bacon. But I think I felt, after watching it, I felt somewhere between Mike and Eric. I did like some aspects of this film. I thought the performances were very strong. I think there was some good chemistry here and there. And I dislike the idea of the main concept, and there were some cool shots here and there, some eerie or some rather creative, but it was okay in my opinion. I think it is getting hit pretty damn hard, a little too hard by the critics and stuff like that, but it's not exactly a great film either in my opinion.
I definitely could. I think, in my opinion, it falls more into the category of psychological thriller than a horror film. There are some horror elements in there, but there is more of a mystery and a more of a character examination going on here. And I think it was hit and miss in that area for me. I think I would also just tell people if they honestly were really interested in seeing the movie to wait till there was more of but a streaming for services are using it gives them a free usage to watch the film. Just mainly because I felt that this is not exactly something that you should be rushing out to rent because, while not terrible, it's not exactly anything groundbreaking or anything that is going to be at the top of anyone's to watch list of this year. But it's certainly not another thing to hate about 2020 either.
All right, sounds good. So that's our five opinions on this film. So it's kind of everywhere. And with all that, Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki.
A former banker, his actress wife, and their spirited daughter book a vacation at an isolated modern home in the Welsh countryside where nothing is quite as it seems.
All right, yeah, that's a good one.
Somebody's watching me.
I'm good with that wiki. It doesn't give away too much.
Right.
So that's good. I actually had to watch the trailer because my wife, when we choose films, she has to watch the trailer. And the trailer is actually pretty damn good. It's really good. And I actually peeked because they have that great scene where he's measuring the outside of the house. And it's like, oh, that's a cool concept. So the trailer is really good.
It's very TARDIS. It's very TARDIS.
What's that mean?
Bigger on the inside.
It's a Doctor Who reference.
Yeah, there's a phone booth.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I saw the trailer. All right. So I think that's good enough for that. So before we get into our spoiler part, I guess we can discuss anything and everything related to the folks that starred in the film, directed the film, or general things about the film. I haven't read the book. I never even knew this book existed until this came out. And yeah, it's a German book, which is interesting. But I don't know much about the author or the book. Anything that anybody wanted to bring up specifically?
Has that book been localized, or is it still only in German?
That's a really good question. It is translated into English, so yeah, it's available anywhere you want.
Okay.
Yeah, so that is good. The original title was "Du hattest gehen sollen," which actually means you should have left in German. What else? Anything else anybody want to bring up before we just talk about anything and everything?
It's kind of difficult to talk about the film because you start to really unearthing a lot of spoilers as you go along.
Right. Well, let me just set it up a little bit. Kevin Bacon is remarried after having a wife that died, supposedly suicide or mistaken overdose or something like that. He marries a younger woman. That's 28 years younger than him, who's a famous actress. They have a child together. As mentioned in the wiki, he's a very, very, very wealthy banker or retired banker who is more famous for other reasons, which we'll discuss in the spoiler territory. But obviously, his wife is well known too. The relationship seems pretty solid, though her career is kind of on the up while his career is on the down just for the fact that he's older, retired, and some issues that occurred in his personal life prior to his marriage with her. And that's pretty much how the movie's set up. at the beginning. Now, I mentioned the issues. I mean, they set it up pretty quickly at the beginning where the husband goes to the set to meet his wife for lunch. They won't let him on because they either don't identify him or it's a closed set. And also she's filming a sex scene in a car. And obviously that's uncomfortable for him, but it's like it's his wife, but they won't let him through. And she was supposed to let them know. And so there's some weird things going on there. I don't know if anybody wants to add to that.
Well, there's a lot of interesting things that are going on in this setup. You know, Suzanne is the wife. She's an actress. And we find out pretty easily or pretty quickly that this is told from the husband Theo's point of view. That's the Kevin Bacon character. But what makes it interesting is that he really is kind of an unreliable narrator. He's, you know, we know that he's got severe issues with jealousy. We know in those first few setup scenes that there's something dark in his past that's only lightly alluded to. We know that he's having issues sexually. But we always know there's something off. And at first, the young wife comes off as very genuine and really loving and loving the older man. But as things get going, there's clues that kind of point to the idea that she's really just a thrill junkie. She does make a comment in those opening scenes to him in the car when he says, oh, you know, they wouldn't let me on the set. And she's like jabbering about the sex scene or whatever. And he says, I swear they recognized me, which is the first clue that something is off. And she says, they think you're dangerous. And then a breath later, she's like, want to do me in the car. Then later on, we find out she's addicted to murder porn. So, you know, I think that maybe part of her attraction to him is the fact that, you know, ooh, he was on TV with this big case. And that was sort of that's her thrill junkie. She is attracted to dangerous things. And, you know, there's even that line where she says to him, I do lots of things I shouldn't. And of course, we find out later that she's cheating. So that's all threaded through the whole thing. The fact that she is really, and also there's a ton of references in there. Theo saying to her, or her referring to herself, well, I'm a pretender. It's what I do for a living. You know, I stand up and she has a dream where it's a typical actress dream where you stand up on a stage and you don't know your lines. But still, that's a reference to later on when she gets caught cheating. You know, she really doesn't know what to say. And she's just like, I don't want to do this. So she is a little bit of a trickster herself. And one of the themes, I think, of this movie is secrets. You know, what we keep from each other in relationships. That I think, is one of the themes. But yeah, anyway, we all have things to talk about. So I'll be quiet for now and I'll come back to it.
I would say that it also kind of like how things appear on the surface, not what they seem within the inside of it. The very fact that on the outside we see a pretty happy family, but as you go inside of in depth of them, you see there is some secrets and serious issues. That's the same thing for our main setting, the house, in which it seems just like a typical resort, but once you go inside and then you kind of examine it a little more closely, you see there's a lot of dark corners and secrets and things that are just completely off. So it's definitely about depths, and you know, the deeper you dig into things, the darker those truths turn out to be.
Yeah, that's a fair point, Abe. And that's the question I've always been curious: is are couples that are like one of like Chrissy mentioned, you said that Amanda Seyfried's character is like a thrill seeker, and it's probably not even because of not liking her husband or loving her husband or anything. It's just that, oh, it's another piece of ass. I can you know, do it on the side. You know, so that is it really is it an issue, the marriage, really bad, or is it simply the fact that she looks at things lackadaisical? That's, I've always wondered that, because you always see these divorces where there is real hatred or unlikability, and they cheat. And then there's the ones that, like, oh, there's an opportunity, and then they do it.
Well, I think, to answer your question, Phil, I think when you're talking about an affair, and I think I might have mentioned this before, when women cheat, it's usually because there is something that they perceive in their current relationship that is missing. So I think in this case with her, it's a little bit more complicated because, yes, she's the thrill seeker. And that's even kind of echoed in the scene where the daughter's climbing the tree. Because the daughter's climbing the tree and going higher and higher kind of mirrors the mother's attraction to danger. Which, of course, then we find out, you know, what really happened, or the mother, you know, Susanna explains to Ella, the daughter, what happened with her father. But I think one of the issues here, Phil, is it could be a combination of both things. Clearly, there is an issue with their sex life. And she even says to him, I'm greedy, which means that she needs more than he supposedly physically or romantically can give out. We don't know what those reasons are. It's not necessarily age, I don't think, although age is mentioned. You know, I mean, this is a troubled guy. He's got a lot going on. And a lot of times guys that are that complicated, they really, believe it or not, they're not very sexual. There's just too much going on upstairs. And I also think, though, that because of that, you know, they've settled in, they've got a daughter. She continues to work even though she doesn't have to. And I think some of that is just sheer boredom. She wants those thrills. Like you said, Phil, she wants to get away with it. And she wants something she can get away with. And there's even a line later in the movie where she says to Theo, you're terrible at sneaking around. And it's the way she says it that is kind of like, I'm great at it. You know what I mean? It's sort of like implied, like, I've been pulling the wool over your eyes forever. Of course, we don't find that out until a couple scenes later, what she's been doing. But when you watch it a second time, you pick up on that. So I think, Phil, in this case, my personal opinion is just that I think that there may be both issues going on. And that's why. I don't think she doesn't love him. I mean, I think she genuinely loves him. I just, because then there's that whole conversation later about, Daddy, do you love me enough? You know? So it's really a question of, is this guy meeting every single need she has? He's clearly not meeting the thrill-seeking need, and he's not meeting the need for enough sex. Does she love him? Yes. I mean, a lot of times, too, when women cheat, it's not because they don't love the man they're married to. It's because that man is not giving them something that's missing, and they can't get it. So they go outside of the home to find it. Did I answer your question, or did I just create more questions?
No. I think you answered it well enough. And in this case, this film, these characters, that could most certainly be it for sure. Yeah, I mean, she's an actress, and so she likes attention. She likes being in the public eye. Like you said, she could just quit and stay, you know, do a quiet job or just hang out with her child or whatever. But you know, she's a young working woman and beautiful and the type of person that likes attention, and not necessarily narcissist, just likes attention, and that's the job that she has. And so that type of personality makes her more apt to be, a thrill seeker. So, yeah, and this guy, the husband, even if he is a little older or whatnot, he is probably at the point where he wants to avoid the public eye as much as possible because of his issues from the past. So,
yeah, it's,
so
the
opposite.
There's mentioned that, you know, in the film, it mentions how he is trying to, he feels like he has, you know, because he has been found, you know, the wife mentions how Theo has been found innocent, and, you know, that should be enough. Apparently, you know, you think it'd be enough to be like, you know, he should be allowed to move on. He's been, you know, cleared of what he was accused of, but everybody else in the world, or so many of them, are don't want him to, or won't let him. And so, throughout this film, Theo is dealing with a lot of his issues, unpacking them through not only to listen to meditation, like recordings or sessions on his headset, but he's also keeping a track of his emotional state and what he's feeling in a journal, which becomes another key thing that's used in the story. And it's also been a clue of there's something weird going on as well.
Right, right. No, that's valid observations. What else? What else do we want to talk about? These setup scenes. Let me ask you this, Chris. You brought it up. He's kind of an unreliable narrator. How did you figure that out early? As we find out later, it's most certainly true. But how did you picked it up? It seems at the beginning.
Oh, well, there's five basic characteristics of the unreliable narrator, or five basic things that help you kind of spot him, because not every first person film and not every first person short story or novel is an unreliable narrator. Just because it's told from the first person point of view, or in a film, if we're kind of seeing it all through the lens of, in this film, it's Theo, the husband, doesn't mean it's unreliable. The way you can tell is there's usually a some kind of trauma or damage in the past. That's number one, because that shows you that there's probably something is not quite right in their world, or in the way they perceive things. The second thing is a negative perception. And in this movie, in the first, you know, 5-10 minutes, you see he has a very negative perception of the world around him. The third one is the way the other characters treat the narrator. They treat him with kid gloves, or they're reassuring, you know. And in this movie, we definitely see the wife trying to reassure him, and we definitely see that guy, you know, on the film set being like, "Oh, sorry, you can't come in," and kind of like treating him sort of weird and uncomfortably. So there's that. The fourth thing. Oh, there's two more, and I can't remember what they are, but there's two more. And I know that this movie hit all five bells in the first 10 minutes.
All right. So I guess we're going to throw up the spoiler alert. So we'll discuss anything and everything.
There's an element of the unexplained and or the supernatural. So there's something that leaves doubt in your mind as to whether or not this is real or not. And of course, it's that moment where they said, "Well, I didn't rent this house." And the other one says, "Well, I didn't rent it either." So there's your first clue that something isn't right. And then the fifth thing is the trigger. And the trigger is, this goes into the whole Poe-esque trigger thing. Yay, everybody take a drink. I said Poe-esque. that's the trigger that drives this fragile person over the edge. In other words, this guy in this particular film, this guy is very well held together, right? He's very controlled. He's very emotionally controlling of his own emotions. He's very controlling over his reactions. This trigger is that he, you know, suspects that his wife is cheating on him, which is a jealousy issue, which we see kind of ties back to, you know, what had happened prior. So,
yeah,
anyway.
To add to that, Chris, see, there is, since we're in spoilers, there's a moment where Theo confronts her about her infidelity, and she even calls him out saying, you know, "I wish you would scream and yell like a normal person." You know, he's very calm when he addresses her, which actually makes him more uncomfortable than if he had come out and confronted her outright in a, you know, aggressive manner.
Yeah. Well, but we also understand why, right? If you sneak a peek at some of the things he's writing in his notebook, he, you know, and he's going through this whole therapy thing, you know, whatever it is. He's dealing with anger management issues. He can't let go, right? He can't explode at her, and she's pushing him to do it, which is, given everything that we eventually find out, a very bad idea. But yeah, so you can understand where this is going to be an issue with this relationship. She's going to want something out of the relationship he cannot emotionally provide in that way, right? He can't give that sort of openness and honesty.
Right, right. Well, and that's a question I had, Mike, which is that his anger, is that the reason why he's always on edge with her? Is that part of the jealousy thing? What do you think?
He's trying to contain himself. He's just her. And we have no reason to think, or I didn't have a reason necessarily to think that she really was having an affair. She's on the phone a lot, right? But you're kind of being led to believe that here's a guy who is ill-tempered and a bit paranoid, right? And partly because he's telling us that. You know, he's telling us that he has these emotional issues. And he's writing about it in his journal. And then he's also just getting annoyed that she's always on her fucking phone. Well, you know, he's a little older than we are, and she's clearly much younger. And so, yeah, that's a generation thing. Well, she's also, again, a part of the problem, that big a gap in the relationship. So we have no reason to believe that his fears are founded until they are. You know, he's upset because he walks in on her in a film shoot while she's faking an orgasm. We're supposed to be faking an orgasm. You know, so there's all these things feeding into his worst aspects, and we see that eroding. It's kind of like being an alcoholic and everybody's passing drinks around in front of you.
Right. There's a lot of stresses surrounding him that start to break down his defenses. He spent so much time trying to build up.
Right. So, maybe I was clueless about some of these details, but I didn't suspect that she was really having an affair. I thought he was being paranoid. I thought we were being sold, you know, being sold to us that here's a guy who's paranoid, right? And that
yeah,
going to
totally.
Be
yep.
Sort
and
of
that's
like
why it was so cool when it happened. I was like, oh my god, it's real. Like I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Right. So part of it is, you know, I was kind of expecting him to be a bit of a Jack Torrance, right? Because you start kind of with, oh, this guy has a dark secret, which is really that everybody doesn't like him for not a good reason, for no good reason whatsoever, other than people are judgmental. You know, and reality is, no, he is like Jack Torrance. He's an alcoholic who's, well, not literally. He's a person who has done some bad things in his past, and now he's put into a very bad position, right? And again, that's actually, yeah, I'm actually seeing that like kind of a parallel now that I had missed before, right? There is a bit of a shining thing here. So just in this case, it's her cheating that really starts, that getting caught kind of brings it out of him. But, yeah, it was just weird because I know we're being sold on what a good guy this is on one hand, and the other hand, I'm getting the sense of, yeah, I kind of see where this is going, and it's going to turn out he really is a dick, and he really did do it, and that's why he has to go through all this therapy stuff so he can proclaim his innocence as much as he wants. He isn't. Right, so I never really quite bought into him as the guy they were selling him as. Do you follow?
Yeah,
I gotcha.
Yeah, so, well, you're right, because, I mean, you're hoping he wasn't going to be guilty of why the ghosts are, I guess, after him, or whatever you want to call what was after him. But the movie was kind of, you know, another kind of film that it reminded me of was like Shudder, the Thai film, where you like the lead, character, but he's actually has something in his background that's bad that's unfortunately going to make him be doomed by the end. And so you're right. You could probably see that way ahead of the ending, right? I mean, you said you saw it pretty soon early, right, Mike?
Yeah, I knew that it was going to be. You said in a recent episode of Lovecraft Country, right, that it was an hour episode built out of a half hour Twilight Zone. And yeah, that's right, very much what I was kind of feeling here, is that this could have made a really awesome 30 to 45 minute Twilight Zone kind of story. And then there's a lot of padding, right, to go where, like, when it's a 30 minute story that you can kind of see where it's going to end, isn't that big a deal. When it's a 90 plus minute story, and you kind of see where it's going, to me, that's more of a problem. And when you get characters that I'm not really sure how I'm supposed to be feeling about them, that just makes it a little bit harder to get through. But yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, I did kind of like their chemistry. I liked their relationship. I really kind of loved the scene that comes later after they have their fight and they have the makeup. I kind of liked the way that was played. And then to me, it was kind of not gut-wrenching, because I didn't have that strong a reaction. It was really disappointing when it turned out she was in fact having that affair. All right. But I also wouldn't say it was hugely surprising, given everything we had learned about them up to that point.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I guess you're right. I wasn't expecting her necessarily to be guilty of the affair either. And then when it happens, it was kind of depressing more than any anger I had. And then I guess I was trying to think, all right, so how can they save the marriage? You know, but if by then, you know, then the main plot of the movie happens after that, and it doesn't really matter. But I guess his suspicions, even if they were right, they also showed his controlling, if not controlling, you know, looking through her notebook or checking her phone or whatever to make sure she wasn't cheating. It was more commentary on him than on her having the affair, I think, because it shows his personality was kind of almost obsessive. But I don't know.
You can be paranoid, doesn't mean they're not out to get you, right? Is that he was paranoid, but maybe now whether we had reason to be paranoid or not, it's hard to say because we haven't been in that relationship long enough. But it turns out his paranoia was justified.
Yeah, that is true. Yep. You're right. You're right. Yeah, it does suck. And yeah, maybe that's why he was obsessive about it, because again, we only see their relationship the moment the movie starts. Maybe there were things earlier that we don't know about. And so, yeah, we're not in his situation. So it may not really even been obsessive. It may have just been at the point where a break where he said, okay, I gotta start looking. So that's a fair point. Yeah. All right. So what else do we want to move on to? What piece? Chris, you said you liked the house.
You know, as you guys know, I'm a huge ghost story, haunted house story person. And so I watch an awful lot of these movies, and it was just very refreshing to see a modern house that was creepy in its own way. Like, it was very bright, right? It certainly had lots of windows. And yet somehow they made that atmosphere of that ultra modern, really beautiful house full of light extremely creepy. It was almost tomb-like. And the way that they were able to create shadows in the house, even though there really wasn't a whole lot to throw shadows on. It's also interesting, too, in that what I found interesting was the whole use of light, right? In that there's that scene when they first get there and he's running around shutting off all the lights, and it's sort of like, and then there's lights that don't go out. So this house played a role in the whole chiaroscuro, I believe, of this film, which is light represents the truth, right? He's sitting there trying to close, to shut off all the lights, and yet some of the lights stay on.
He can't control the
truth. Right. Yeah. He can't. And at first, Nathan and I actually discussed this movie at length. At first, Nathan says, well, you think the reason the lights don't shut off is because the shadow person's there, right? And the shadow person needs the light. But then as the story moves forward, you realize that the reason the lights stay on is because it's really just a symbol for him not being able to avoid the truth for too much longer. He spends the whole movie trying to control the truth, like he controls his reactions, like he controls his emotions, like when Susanna tells Ella what supposedly really happened between him and his first wife. He gets mad at her and he says to the wife, I wanted to be the one to tell that story exactly the way I wanted to tell it when I thought it was correct timing. So he's always constantly trying to control the truth, and the house won't let him. You know.
And I'll also say,
go ahead.
Now let's ignore all the surrounding issues. I do think he was totally right in that.
Totally right.
Definitely
in
stepped
what?
Out of bounds. In her, when she told his story, I think she was out of bounds. It was his story to tell.
Yes. Yes. Oh, no. I completely agree with you. It should have been done together, you know.
Well, ideally, yes. But at the same time, if you got a kid coming at you like that looking for answers,
yeah.
What are you going to do? Are you going to lie to him? She should have said, why don't we talk about this with your dad? Maybe that would have been a better way to approach it. But I don't think she was any type of horrible person for reacting the way she did.
No, I don't either. I don't think that he was really justified in freaking out.
I think it was more of his own personal issues about, because I mean, he chooses a very strange age they claim that he wants to tell.
Oh yeah. Oh, seven. But okay. Like, I don't know what the... And she even says, that's so arbitrary. Like, why do you... You know?
Mm-hmm.
That's just an arbitrary number to me. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's not like he's waiting for it to be like, you know, his early teens or an adult or anything like that.
Well, it might depend... I'm sorry. I probably should know this, being a teacher. But I don't deal with elementary school kids. It depends on... where the kid is in terms of mental and emotional development. And I don't really know where they are at age seven. But they are kind of moving slowly, but they are at that point where they're kind of moving out of that age of innocence. They're not obviously up to your teen years, you know, but they can start handling more complex things. So I can understand why picking an age like seven, although, again, you know, everyone's a little different. But it's also like, I mean, imagine this is a, now we also understand the truth, but let's go with the story he has. He's probably going to be more sensitive to this because he's hiding, because this whole thing is a cover-up. But let's flip the script here, and let's say that it was her secret, that, I don't know, maybe she had been raped at an early age, and he's the one that tells the kid about that. Well, it's not his story to tell, it's hers, right? And it doesn't matter whether you agree with when she wants to tell the kid the story or not, right? That's her choice. So, yeah, I understand him being, and it's a, for him, a very deeply personal issue. And I imagine it's a deeply personal issue if, in fact, the story he's telling was true. So I understand why he'd want to have some control over it, especially since it is his child that you're dealing with.
Well, and also, I got to say, I understand his guilt, but when he finally reveals at the end what happened, he says, "I killed her." And I don't know if I necessarily agree with that statement. He didn't save her. I think it's a little different. It might be splitting hairs.
Well, but the first thing that sprung to mind is Walter White in the second season of Breaking Bad, where he allows Jesse's girlfriend to die,
right,
choke on her own vomit rather than save her.
And
that did spawn, you know, an argument is, you know, was that like the, was that like his evil twist? How evil was that? Because he didn't kill her per se.
Right.
He
right,
just
right.
didn't save her.
Well,
right, you know, and that's also going to be, now this is
it might be a semantic argument, but I disagree with the statement. When he says, "I killed her," I don't necessarily agree 100% with that statement.
Well, he does say, Eric, and by the way, I do agree with you, but he does say, "I hated her." And this is where the line of the movie title comes in, because he says, "I should have left years before." Mm-hmm. So "you should have left" actually not only refers to the house, it does also refer to his own
previous marriage
situation, his previous marriage. But yes, I do agree with you, Eric, although it's the thing about hating that really kind of made me change my mind a little bit, because he said, "I hated her," like, or something that he said. So I was sort of like, oh, I'm also not sure. If, because he is such an unreliable narrator, I'm still not sure that's the whole truth either at the end of the movie.
Right. But Eric has a fair point, because here we have, I guess, the devil wanting his soul. And what he did, you could say, is bad for sure, because he could have saved her. But Eric has a point, which is, I mean, there's a lot of people. All you have to do is you know, look in the news, and you see a lot of people that the devil should be bringing to that house before Kevin Bacon, probably. But
right, right,
yeah, definitely true.
So that is a fair point. What Eric's saying, which is, okay, so, you know, we can all agree that it was probably bad that he didn't save her, for sure.
I mean, he's definitely got a reason to feel guilty. For sure.
Yeah.
And also, if you have a conscience, you can easily take on more guilt for a thing than what you are really responsible for. Right. Whatever her situation was, it sounds like she might have ended up dead if he did nothing. Right. I mean, that's bad phrasing, because he did nothing and she did die.
Yeah.
But I mean, if let's say he had saved her, then she might well have died anyway, right? Because of her, she was clearly abusing her medication. She was clearly a person who, or at least from what we have been told in the story, if that is an accurate portrayal, she was kind of out of control and things may have ended badly anyway. In the end, she's the one who put herself in that position. And I'm not trying to say she deserved to die. And maybe if he had saved her, her life would have turned around. Maybe her eyes would have opened. There's all sorts of things that could have happened. But I can totally understand why he's blaming himself for a thing that he maybe is not 100% responsible for.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And there's still a mystery, even after the truth comes out, of what kind of person this woman was, you know. Was she an abuse, aside from her drugs, was she an abusive person, you know, emotionally or physically to them? We don't really get much about her as a character, aside from that little bit there.
Go ahead, Dean.
All you get is that it was a very unhappy marriage, but we don't really know the aspect is what drove the wedge between them, aside from maybe her abuse of those substances. Maybe that was all it was.
Well, I'll say this, Abe. I think the point of what the devil and his guilt are trying to say, because the devil, in a sense, is the punishment for the guilt, is that even if she was an abusive and terrible person, which it sounded like it was, assuming we believe his story and what his new wife believes, that still doesn't necessarily mean that she should have been dead, right? I mean, technically what he should have done was just divorce her and suck it up like Jeff Bezos did and lose 50% of his wealth, because even it appears that he's like, you know, close to a billionaire. So that's what he should have done, right? I mean, but what he chose to do was morally ambiguous at best and damn evil at worst, right? So he should have just sucked it up and divorced her.
Yeah, but that's you know, considering that he had a better, easier choice than some the average Joe could. You know, if, imagine this was a gender flip, and the you know, and the woman was being beaten and stuff like that by an abusive husband and stuff like that. I mean, those domestic abuse situations can get very lethal at times.
Yeah, and, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Yeah, the double standard that. It's always the woman. It's never the man that is the victim.
Well, it's also the very fact that, you know, Kevin Bacon's character had a lot of wealth. He was totally a banker. So, yeah, he could walk away with a lot of money. But, you know, if this was like a normal person or something like that, or gender flip, you know, it's someone's being badly put into a position that could even get dangerous. You know, the divorce usually sounds like the easier answer, but those kind of relationships become so toxic and trapping that sometimes it's hard to escape. And,
yeah.
You know, so is it like, for example, if we do the gender flip and say the woman was being beaten and violently abused by her husband and stuff like that, was she supposed to just suck it up and just deal with it, you know? Because those situations get pretty dangerous, and so it feels like, yeah, if her abusive husband was drowning in the pool, should she really save him? Even if it means she could finally be free of his wrath.
Yeah, all right. I see what you're saying, too. These are fair points. These are fair points, because, yeah, if an abusive individual, in your analogy being a guy, comes home and starts yelling at, you know, the regular abuse that he gives his wife, but he falls drunk into a stupor and then rolls off the lawn chair into the pool, and the wife just watches him drown, is she evil or just morally ambiguous? So I see your point. That's actually a pretty good analogy, I think.
Or for example, let's go to even younger age. Let's say that a parent or a family member is sexually abusing a younger member of the family, and that child or that younger person sees that person get put in that situation, is he guilty for letting that person die, even though it might mean that because she tries, would that mean she's guilty, or he or she is guilty of it, even though he trying to tell the truth, hasn't done anything?
Right. No, that's fair. Well, anybody else have thoughts on that pretty awesome analogy that A is makes? I mean, Chrissy, for example, if it was the opposite way and the guy falls into the pool and the woman just says, oh, this is my opportunity to get away from an abusive relationship, is this that is the same type of analogy, or is it different in your opinion?
No, I think it's the same type of analogy. Totally.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I still feel like, you know, the only indication that we have that this woman might have been abusive, Abe, is when in his, you know, toward the end, when he's like down in the basement area there. And she springs from the tub and attacks him. That was an indication there. Well, you could have taken that two ways, that he was, you know, haunted by his own guilt for letting her die, or that that really was sort of the way that she metaphorically treated him. Mm-hmm. But I'm not so sure. Like, he's like, oh, I let her die. I just really think that in order, because there's also a whole thing about sin going on through this. And sin is actually a three beat. Sin is mentioned in the beginning. You know, it says it's not nice. It's a sin. It's a sin to curse, whatever. Then the second time it's mentioned is when Theo and Suzanne are in their bedroom suite and he's apologizing to her for being an asshole, basically. And he says something like, I shouldn't have said that. It's a sin. Then the third time that it's mentioned is toward the end when the shopkeeper is explaining this to him and says, it's all about sin. You know, the house takes the sinners or whatever the heck it is. To me, you can have guilt over watching someone die and not saving them and letting it happen. But it's killing them that's a sin. I don't necessarily think standing by and watching somebody die is a sin. There could be a lot of reasons for that. You could be paralyzed. Maybe he just was really like, I didn't want to save her because, like you said, Phil, it's my way out. You know what I mean? That's not necessarily a sin. Sometimes it's just your escape route. You got to take it. But I just don't, based on some of his behavior and how controlled this character is, I really don't think he's telling the truth even at the end. Because otherwise, his eternal punishment kind of doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't balance. Does that make any...
I agree 100% about that. I did not feel it balanced with the crime. The crime, you could argue, is bad for sure, whatever. But based off of what you see on the news versus someone that just decided to sit back and let something happen that they're not actually responsible for, the crime of this hell house and Satan and all this other stuff seemed pretty rotten for sure. It didn't fit.
Yeah.
I assume that's what you mean, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
And it most makes me think about the idea that, for example, what if this, we'll say this is a bystander witnessing a terrible incident, whether this is a car accident or something like that, and the situation was too dangerous, and they didn't try to save him or to escape whatever dangers was in the way, whether it was a fire or something like that, are they automatically guilty for not saving them, even though we can understand that they would be trying to survive and keep out of danger themselves?
Right. You know, what about you, Mike? What do you feel about the punishment of this quote-unquote crime with what, you know? I mean, obviously the guilt is killing the guy, for sure.
You know, there's
he's a narcissist, and he's just like, doesn't want to get caught. I don't know. But
there are some belief systems, and I don't know if they're legitimate belief systems. I should say not legitimate. I don't know if they're traditional belief systems or if they're like people just navel gazing at their own spirituality, where seems to suggest that that a lot of the guilt and your eventual punishment is determined by your emotional guilt as opposed to your actual guilt, right? So your torture in hell, I've seen several authors use this, is determined by how much you beat yourself up over a thing that you did. Not over the magnitude of what you did, but how badly do you feel for it? And until you learn to forgive yourself, you'll always suffer for it. And so he clearly feels really bad about what he's done and probably feels even worse that he's gotten away with it. He's kind of become famous for it. He's gotten a hot young wife out of this. And this beautiful child he has, I don't know if anyone freeze-framed some of the notes he wrote. But one of the notes he wrote, he talks about his conflicted feelings at watching his child being born. And I think he mentions that she was born with Emma being born with a cord wrapped around her neck. But the fear he feels, the elation of being a father and the terror of being a father. You know, so even there, he has conflicted feelings even about his daughter. And again, his daughter's life. And so, now, I do want to be, was the daughter Samantha's daughter?
Yes. This daughter was their child. But so they were okay. Biological.
I thought it was, but I wasn't.
I had questions about that, too.
Yeah, but my wife had problems with it, too. And then finally, there was one scene you finally actually figure it out. I actually had to stop the film and look on Wiki to verify, and it said, okay, it's their husband and wife, because what my wife felt was,
well, we know their husband and wife.
I'm sorry, they were father and mother. My wife thought for half the film that Ellie was Bacon's child, but not Siegfried's child.
See, I thought it was the other way around. I thought that's it was her child from another relationship.
Yeah, see, and my wife thought it was Bacon's child from another relationship.
I was on with your wife because I was thinking she was like stepmom, that mom, we knew mom died, and then she came in and she's kind of young. I get the sense that they would be long to have a 6-year-old daughter. But I wasn't saying, you know, for any way, shape, or form that was definitive. I was very uncertain.
I think part of the problem, too, was that instead of Ella calling him Daddy, she kept calling him Baba, which is kind of weird. Like, I understand that you have different affectionate names for your parents or for your grandparents, but I think that was a mis- if I had been the writer, I wouldn't have done that. Just because of the age difference between the husband and wife, it does make it confusing. We were all confused about it. I mean, it crossed my mind at one point, too. I'm like, wait a minute. Is that really? So I think all five of us had an issue with that. And even Nathan said to me, why the fuck is that her real dad? Because why is she calling him Baba? That does really not make sense. It just for the sake of clarity in the film, they just should have had her call him Dad.
Right. They should have had a scene right at the beginning that showed somehow that, you know, the day you were born, you know, we loved you or whatever. You know, so we all knew right off, understood that it was the product of them. Because my wife felt Amanda Seyfried's character was too stepmommy to the girl, like trying over hard to be a friend rather than a mom. And I was going, yeah, that's a fair point. But there was. So I don't. Yeah, it was just confusing. So it appears that we were all confused, including. What about Pam or Nathan? Did either of you, them? I know Nathan watched it. Was he confused? And was Pam for you, Mike?
Nathan was confused at first. Nathan was confused at first, and Nathan said the whole reason he was confused was because of that Baba shit. He said if he just call her daddy, I wouldn't have even questioned it. But if Baba, what I mean, that's what you call like a stepdad or something. Like it's, I don't know, it's weird. Yeah, that's just my personal opinion. But
sure. Yeah. All right. Okay. So. So either way, whoever asked the question, it's both their daughter, even if it was confusing. I'm not sure where we were going with that. Otherwise, though, where were we going with that?
That was just a curiosity thing because that would have been a, you know, because so is this his daughter from the original mom? So, but in other words, because his wife died, right? He not only got a hot young wife out of it, he also got a daughter out of it, right? He wouldn't have the daughter if the mother was still alive. So he is benefiting. And of course, and the mom isn't just a hot young mom. She's a burgeoning movie star, right?
Yeah.
So now he's already wealthy from being a banker. And we have no idea really where she is on the thing. But let's be honest, banging a hot young movie star is pretty high up there on the wish list factor, right? And one of these things that would be a status symbol and all sorts of things that kind of come with that. So right. he's well, just
well, oh, and that's probably fans. Contributing yeah. to his ongoing insecurities about the whole relationship, because he's like, oh God, I feel guilty about letting my first wife die. Now I've got this hot young actress wife, and there's no way this is going to last because I don't deserve it, and she's going to leave me, and because I'm scum.
Right. Well, and never mind the fact that, you know, he is just a businessman, even if he's semi-famous. She's the hot young actress that every guy, you know, probably hits on. So, yeah, so he's always, you know, that if you're insecure as it is, that's always going to be stressing you out, you know. So, but you're right. I think what you said, Eric, is a really good point, because again, a lot of this film is about the guilt, you know, and does he deserve? And that's an excellent observation, I feel. Hey, what about your thoughts? You usually are pretty good at dissecting that stuff.
I mean, I can definitely see that there is a bit of. I felt the character was dealing with not only his guilt, but also the sense of his own mortality, because there is this conversation between him and his daughter about, you know, him getting older and passing away. The idea that, because she asked, you know, because he gives this feel about everybody going to be together in the afterlife, and she asks, does everyone go to heaven? And he kind of tries to dodge the question. Because I guess the very concept of is scaring him. And, you know, not only is he the idea that, yeah, I'm much older now. I'm not as young as you used to be. You know, I got this beautiful wife and I got a wonderful daughter, but I'm much older than them. I'm not going to be around as long. Heaped on top of him, of course, is his dark past and stuff like that. So now he is on over the hill, and he's just trying to question about what he has now, and does he deserve what he has now, and yeah, because of what he has done in the past, and if there's a heaven, then there must be a hell, and would he be forgiven, and would he be with his family because of what he feels guilty over. So I feel there's two sides of this struggle right here, not just with his own insecurities, but his own fear of his own soul.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, that's the thing too, right? It's not just his own insecurities and his guilt, but even though religion doesn't really play a huge part in this film, obviously the devil is based in Christianity and Judaism and whatnot. It appears that his character also is worrying about his soul as well, not just his wife and his reputation. You know, so I think that's another interesting aspect of this film, the guilt of being guilty of quote unquote a crime. His reputation is thrown into the gutter, worrying about the wife and all that. But I think the main thing, especially someone that actually believes in the afterlife, your soul is lost. And at least that's what he's thinking. His soul is lost, I think. And that's what he believes.
Well, and that's basically what it comes down to, right?
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, I also think what's sort of interesting, too, is that there's this whole mention, of course, of the devil and sin, which I said earlier. But what's also kind of cool is that, you know, in the end, the person that there's that whole comment about the person that's always in the mirror is just yourself. And so it kind of begs the question or suggests that there is no real devil. The only devil is ourselves, really, and the only hell is the one that we create, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought that was an interesting double message, if you wanted to go that far with it. I just thought it was something worth mentioning.
Of that, I just wanted to mention this because this was probably my favorite moment in the movie, is when I think it might be during one of the dream sequences where he's sitting there writing. and he looks up from his writing and his reflections in the window, looking back at him, and then he turns to see what's behind him, and his reflection doesn't follow. It's still staring at him.
Yeah, that was awesome. When the first time we watched that, Nathan, I was like, oh my God, did I just see that?
Right, it happens quick. Too. And then I had to rewind it. I was like,
rewind. Yep, rewind. It was so cool. I love that moment. I thought it was
And then
really
they did it again a second later. I was like, oh, that's some cool shit. That's awesome.
Yeah, I also like the little shadow in the window as to try and get from the house. Because it's so far away. It feels so skeletal and almost alien like.
Yes.
It's just so unfamiliar, even though it's his own shadow. I thought that was really cool.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there is a moment, too, where he comes back from town with the groceries, and they deliberately put a long shot on his shadow on the grass.
Yeah.
Which I also thought was very interesting.
Also, did anybody else notice that he had bananas in that box, but he did not ask for bananas?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I thought he was
just hitting on him and giving him a phallic-shaped fruit.
Well, you got to love that. I mean, there's a whole thing about time in this, too. Like, he's clearly – time is so different in this place. Like, that shopkeeper is so damn slow. And there's a lot of nice moments of humor in this, too, which is where I thought this
here comes
did
the
well.
Breath.
Yeah. and to the end, I love too when another moment of humor when he goes, well, I wish you'd said that to Mark. She says, I can't do this, and he's like, or Max, and he goes, I wish you'd said that to Max. And then he's yelling after the car, do you have both your phones? Just some really fun.
Those were good
writing
shots.
Here. Yeah, there were some really good shots in here. They were just sort of funny.
But my favorite parts of this movie were the ones that were in the house where the weird stuff was happening and the layout of the house didn't make sense. And he's trying to find whether and unfortunately, like half of it was during dream sequences, which irked me a little bit, but. Still, the disconcerting nature of him just running around this house that it has a layout that can't possibly be was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was. So we got the relationship part out of the way, his guilt, all that backstory stuff, the stuff that makes or creates why all this happens. But let's talk about the supernatural stuff now, the ghost, the house, the what's going on, the mystery. Who wants to pick that up? Who wants to bring it up? I mean, actually, you brought it up, Eric, but who wants to set it up and explain this? Since it's a ghost story.
I don't know if it could be explained, and it's not supposed to be explained.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, go on, Eric. Yeah, go ahead, please.
I was just going to say that the basically, this house has been around in one form or another for a very long time. There's always been a house on this spot, even though the house is gets knocked down and rebuilt and so on and so forth. And the shopkeeper gives him a it's not a protractor. What is it? I'm totally blanking. What's that thing called? A triangle. He gives him a triangle.
A right triangle
and tells him to check the angles.
However, I would be enough of a dick to give the guy like a mildly acute angle just to fuck with him. Give him something that's like 85 degrees or 95 degrees.
And at one point, he does use it to check the wall, and it's not the same in one place as it is in another. And the whole thing is weird. And so apparently this location is used by, quote-unquote, the devil, for lack of a better term, to lure people whose souls he wants to this house, so he keeps them there forever. I don't understand. Like, okay, eventually at the end of this story, he realizes what's going on. He actually has a confrontation with himself, which was what Christy was talking about earlier, and figures out that, he was brought here because he is a bad dude and deserves to be punished. And he basically sends his wife and daughter away and says, look, I deserve this. I need to stay here. But at the same time, what was unclear to me is whether innocence gets sucked into this situation as well. Like, I'm assuming the devil brings one person here, well, at least at a time, to be kept. Like, would he have kept them too? Had Kevin Bacon not come to the realization and sent them away, even though they're not part of it?
To me, that kind of felt like a... Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Eric. To me, that was a little bit of a hole in that... And yet, when you see all the pictures on the wall, when you do see them toward the end, there are just only one person. Do you know what I mean? They're all pictures of only one person.
And so, were those theoretically the pictures of people who had been kept there?
Yeah, theoretically. I mean, that's how I took it. I mean, it's not explained. Well, but that's sort of how I took it, just because...
Well, it was weird, because there's that one shot where you see, like, three of the pictures on the wall, and then they cut back, and there's, like, six pictures on the wall. It's like, well, what are those? What does it mean? What's going on here?
Yeah, that makes me think of the old superstition of how the camera was supposed to steal souls and stuff like that. That was actually used in... remember the movie The Wailing? That was actually used in the story as well.
The Korean film.
Yeah, the Korean film in which the photographs were meant to capture and trap souls. So maybe that was supposed to be the idea of it, like a collection of souls.
Yeah, but let's remember that we kind of look at torches now as like, almost like a spooky thing, you know, where once upon a time they would have been the deliverer of light. It would have been a good thing. Any technology, as it gets older, suddenly becomes more fodder for ghosts. In a way that a webcam is less likely to. And so Polaroids are archaic technology. So that's a spooky thing now. Where a webcam wouldn't be. You know, an old car from the 1950s, right? There's a reason why Christine, you know, is about a, was it a 57?
Believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. So a 57 Chevy, you know, and it's not about a Tesla. A Plymouth Fury, right? It's not about a Tesla, right? Or it's not about a Hyundai. You know,
Christine remained with the Prius.
With a Civic hatchback. You know, it's just not the same thing, right? The older something gets...
It'll happen. It'll happen.
Right! Things gain power with age. And Polaroids now become a thing of the dark and dusty past, which is just which Abe understands fully because you are young and that's why we hate you. And the rest of us are old. And I can feel as I'm talking and gesturing, I can feel my bones crumbling to dust as I move my arms because we're archaic and ancient and dated.
Jeez, that dark thought.
Mike's just going to explode into dust before the episode's over.
Yeah,
it's going to be like that scene in the Last Crusade.
Nice reference.
Yeah. God.
I'm surprised you've seen that movie. Good. Well done.
It's Abe. Of course he's seen that movie.
Well, yeah, but it came out before I was born, didn't it?
Most of the movies came out before he was born. He's still seen them. I have respect for Abe's ability to delve deep into classics.
Okay.
Yeah, Abe's legit. Abe's legit. Right. He's the guy that put them on one of our lists for movies to do.
He did.
That was impressive.
He also picked the Phantom from 10,000 Leagues.
I'm sorry. That was a blind. That was the worst.
That was pretty good.
Well, that was intentionally the worst choice. I had to add it for variety.
Damn you, Abe Spinney!
The fact I managed to get you all to watch it still tickles my heart.
Anyway. Yeah, so this movie, my favorite parts of it were the whole weird shifting reality, you know, impossible physics type of deal that was going on in this movie. I really enjoyed that aspect of it.
Yeah, it was pretty solid.
It was really well done. Because, you know, they're showing all these hallways that couldn't exist and everything, and then having it changed when he would go back through the same doorway was really solid.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And how you walk out one door and his daughter runs into the house another door, and they're not in the same room, even though they should be. And
right.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff like that. And then, yeah, measuring the stuff. And yeah, I mean, the title sums it up. You should have left. I mean, she should have. Once you figure out that there's something fishy about the house that's supernatural, I'm out of here.
Yeah, well, here's one thing, though, that really kind of... There's this weird, trippy bit going on where we find out that it's him that's writing in his journal. And you would think after... If you wanted to warn somebody, you would try to put a little more detailed explanation of what the fuck's going on, or like...
That was Nathan's issue. Nathan kind of said to me, I had an issue with that, simply because it sort of felt like... why wouldn't you put more detail in there? Like, there was a woman down at the car, you were wearing a blue tie when you went to get these groceries, like something to just kind of indicate other than just get out or whatever, because it doesn't, that was something that kind of didn't, that Nathan noticed. So he said the only explanation I could maybe make up for that, the only explanation I could maybe, you know, kind of invent for that is that he's stuck, that it's faded. In other words, that it's not a loop because he can't actually remember what he did before, right? Because he would remember it. In other words, it's faded. So is fate actually erasing his memory of having done it? Which gets into the whole concept of time loop.
There is no fate but what we make. I'm sorry, that's Terminator.
Yeah, but I mean, that was Nathan's kind of issue with it. You know what I mean? He said that was a hole that was kind of driving him nuts.
Kevin well, Bacon it is, but is it's not. At the same time, we're in the realm of the supernatural here. Because yeah, nothing that's going on here makes any sense at all.
Yeah, that's
including
true.
The geography of the house. So I think that's just one more thing that doesn't make sense, and I'll let it slide.
Right. Yeah, it's let me ask you this: why did the devil do it that way? I don't think it's explained, right?
No.
Does he need to have a reason? He's the devil.
Maybe he's trying to make
him go insane. So he break. Maybe Kevin Bacon's character is so refusal to admit what happened that he has to be broken, and this is the way he's broken. Maybe
sort of like a telltale heart kind of thing.
Right. Exactly.
Well, yeah, he's
tortured until he confesses.
Right.
Well, it also sort of kind of lends itself to the idea that, you know, even though the house is bigger in the inside and smaller on the outside, and there's all this weird stuff going on, it also kind of suggests the human mind, right? I mean, there's all these staircases that kind of go down into the depths of the house. And you know, in hypnosis, stairs are frequently used as a symbol of, you know, dissension into the subconscious. into the deep subconscious. That's a lot of times that's the imagery that's used when they try to hypnotize you. They tell you to imagine yourself going down a flight of stairs, you know, and all this sort of stuff to get to a place of calm. So it is sort of a symbol of the house itself being all crazy and kind of all angled is also a parallel for the human mind, the complexity of the human mind, how the human mind can trick itself, and how we torture ourselves. So I think that's part of the reason why, too, the house was all sort of crazy, in my opinion.
I don't know. The stairs in my mind are more like the Escher diagram. They just keep looping back around each other.
Mm-hmm.
But Yeah. Yeah.
Again, all of this is, I think it's his guilt driving it. It's driving him to eventually confess the truth. And I don't know how much of this is denial is a powerful thing. And I don't quite get the idea of how much of it is that he is lying and withholding the truth and how much of it is that he is denying the truth to himself. You know, it is a thing I do often like to tell my students is that we all lie, and the person we lie to the most is ourselves. So I could easily see him rationalizing what happened and saying and insisting in his mind that he's not the one who did it, he's not the one to blame, and being in denial over the whole thing on a conscious level, where on the subconscious level, that's what's eating away at him. And again, it's that whole metaphor of the light, right? The light turning on to illuminate those secrets he's trying to hide. I don't know that it necessarily matters if he's hiding it from himself or he's hiding it from others, because the outcome is still the same. He has to bring it up and put it out in the light. I did find it. I was thinking, what's the movie? Remember the movie? Was it The Darkness, Phil? Or
The Darkness.
No, not The Darkness. That was a Kevin Bacon film. The other film. Oh, God. It was about the Lights Out.
Oh,
that was a great film. The best film ever.
Right. So when I was watching this early on, I'm watching this early on, I'm thinking this was like reverse Lights Out, because Lights Out, you know, it turns dark and it's spooky. And here it's supposed to be spooky because the lights are on. And I think that was one of the things. It wasn't, I got what they were doing. Lights on, you know, was illuminating and, you know, dispelling the shadows. For a thing that was kind of a ghost story, it didn't feel spooky to me. I don't find a lights on to be a spooky thing. So the atmosphere, again, wasn't always quite working with me, but it does work thematically. And as always, mileage varies. I think it is all just about him bringing up the truth. And torturing him until he confesses. I think the whole reason he hasn't left is because he is not at peace with himself, right? If that's what drives that fracture between him and his wife. If it wasn't there, he might have just left with her because they were about to leave anyway, right? Am I remembering that correctly? Weren't they packing to leave? Then he discovers the phone, and that's the reason that he ends up staying there? Right. If he wasn't suspicious, he would have been gone. If he couldn't make peace with himself, he would have been gone. It was his own internal conflict and his own paranoia that stemmed from it and his own guilt that forces him to stay there. He never had a choice but to stay there. Right. Because it was all going to lead to that event.
Right. Yeah.
Well, that's my thought about that. I've been trying to process that. Just why didn't he just leave? It's like, well, because if he left, it would have. In order for him to have left, he either would A, have not had to check his wife's phone, or B, been able to handle the situation better when he did check the phone. And maybe there could have been some peace and reconciliation, or at the very least, they could have moved it. Like she said, can we just talk about this later? And not interrupted the thing they were trying to do, which was to get the hell out of there.
Right.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
I did enjoy the moment where he was like, "Do you like this house?" She's like, "Not really. What about you? I hate it." And they're like, "Let's go." I was like, Finally, somebody in a horror movie is doing something that's smart. True.
That was refreshing. I have to admit, that was really refreshing because usually let's keep trying to ride this out.
Well, and yet it's the secrets that end up dooming them to their fate, though, because then they're all getting ready to go. She goes outside to play, and that's when he finds the second phone or figures out about the second phone.
Well, honestly,
that's also a three beat. The phone.
That's their fault for going out to this house in the middle of nowhere when you got a 5 or 6 year old child, because you don't go on vacation to get away and not have a place where you can send the kid to do fun stuff. It's like, here, go outside and cut yourself on rusty barbed wire. You know, won't that be fun?
No, but I will say that I thought that scene was really well done when he does discover that she has a second phone. Mm-hmm. I really liked the way they did that, how he's trying to be nice, be like, hey, you guys are cute. And then he realizes that the phone he sees in her hands outside is not the one he's texting. It's like, oh, and it was getting so much better.
Yep. Yeah, that was such a sad moment. And I'll tell you what else was really sad, when he's like, I'm going to call your mommy so she can come back and get us. Uh-huh. And the little girl says, why don't you just call her other phone?
Right.
Which means the girl knew the whole time
that
her mom had two phones and, like, for some reason didn't tell her dad or didn't, I don't know. That just was
I think she just, you know, she's a 6 year old. Right? Mom has two phones. Big deal. You know, she doesn't know any better.
Oh, that's true.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, if I had two cell phones, my 6 year old and my 4 year old would be clueless, to be honest.
Well, at that age, if mom has a lizard tail, you could think that's normal. Yeah. You know.
Phil just made reference to his kid's age when we started this podcast. Phil did not have children.
I know, that's really scary. That is so scary. I am just feeling. What was that about saying we all feel old?
we all are old.
Yeah, so here's one for you. As soon as I get off of here, I'm going to be going online to tutor a former student for college chemistry thing tomorrow. And just kind of dropped out of the blue, reached out to me on Facebook, and she said, you know, you may not remember me. It's been a long time. It's been 7 years. I'm thinking, oh, my God, that's 2 years shorter than the podcast.
Oh, jeez. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, my God.
So do we have anything else to say about this movie?
Well, I guess we can talk about the end.
Well, I did want to mention...
Bacon did it.
I did want to mention one quick thing, and that there is that really cool line that says an ant doesn't know what a cathedral is, or, you know, or something, or a volcano, and you don't know what you can't know. And I just thought that kind of was a nice little homage there to the whole Lovecraftian idea of the knowledge that should not be known, which is, of course, supports the whole one of the themes of the movie, which is keeping secrets, you know. And when you have knowledge that you shouldn't have, what that does to you. I just thought I just wanted to make sure I mentioned that before I forgot it.
Well, I think in addition to Lovecraft mythology, I think it plays into just plain theology, right? The idea that, you know, when you get people saying, well, you know, who dismiss when people say God works in mysterious ways, you know, well, that fucking convenient. You know, I've seen people like say shit like that. And it's like, well, you know, I have to imagine if you're an omnipotent, omniscient being, as the Judeo-Christian God is supposed to be, yeah, it is going to be really fucking hard to understand why he does the things that he does, just like an ant can fucking understand why it is that you do the things that you do, right? So it still works at that level. And if you're talking God and the devil, right, because you're talking devil, so by implication, there is a God. There are larger theological forces at work that our little ant brains can't possibly comprehend, whether it is a Judeo-Christian God, whether it is, you know, a Hindu God, whether it is a Lovecraftian elder being, you know, or whether it is the Elon Musk great simulation that we're trapped in, you know, or whatever it is.
Yep.
Sorry. Grant.
No, that's fair. I know. I agree. Now, let's get to the very end point, which is, all right, so he finds out it is the devil. He knows he's wrong, and he decides to let his wife and daughter go, and he stays behind, which is kind of sad because his daughter now won't have a daddy, and that kind of sucks, to be honest, because he was a decent father to her. You know, it wasn't like if anything, his redemption would be to be a good dad, you know, but of course that ain't gonna happen. So I felt that was unfortunate. And then, of course, the other unfortunate part that I thought of too when I was watching it was the crime didn't fit the punishment didn't fit the crime, kind of.
Yeah, like I mentioned the Shining earlier, like nobody watched The Shining and at the end went, oh, poor Danny Torrance is going to grow up without a daddy now. Right. Nobody thought that he was worse off for not having Jack in his life anymore.
True.
Right. Where here, right, it's not he wasn't trying to abuse the daughter, Emma. He wasn't trying to hurt her in any way. There was no hint of any of that. In fact, the whole time he was worried and he was protective of her. And yep. and he held the daughter when the mother gets caught. He doesn't walk off and leave mom with the kid. He keeps the kid, right? That is, again, sometimes something you right. might not necessarily see. I imagine if you 99% of the time, if you told someone you're going to write the story where there's a husband and a wife and a kid, and dad catches the mom cheating, what are they going to do? Most of the time, dad's going to leave. And the mom will be there with the child. And here, he's with the child. He loves the child. He cares the child. They do have a strong, nurturing relationship. She even gave him a nickname. You know, that's not dad, right? So it has a cute, loving relationship. It's a great relationship with this family within this. And they built up a wonderful thing. So, yeah, it is terrible. And it does seem like bad. And not only is it bad that he's, that seem inappropriate, the punishment he's getting, he's like totally fine with it. All right, see ya, Emma. Have a good life. Dad has got to stay here and suffer for all eternity. Bye. Made peace with this. And that felt weird to me.
I felt it was very bizarre. I mean, I'm leaving my daughter and... also, she doesn't have a daddy, so I don't know.
And I guess because at that point, he knows that that's the only way this is going to end, because he already tried leaving with the daughter, and he ended up back in the same place. The only way for his daughter to have a life is to leave him behind.
He could still be broken up about it.
Yeah, I thought the reaction was a little... weak with the daughter, you know, because when I picture something like a family member leaving forever, especially your parents, and you can't completely understand why, I picture something like the moment in Train to Busan, for example. You know, a big gut-wrenching reaction that your parent is going away forever, it's going to be gone, and you can't really understand why, or you're afraid to accept it. But it was kind of overly... I don't know. I think I imagine someone with this kind of deep connection is her between these two, the daughter and her father. I imagine it would be a stronger, idea that your father's not coming with you ever.
Yeah. Yeah. No. It's. I agree. What else? Any further things anybody has for the film? Anything? Anyone? All right, so I guess we can record it about 2 hours. So before we wrap up our final thoughts, Eric, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it wherever you got this one.
Excellent. And Eric, me, you, and Mike do another podcast?
We do. That one is a monthly podcast called Cinema a la Carte, where we cover movies that wouldn't necessarily fit under the Dark Discussions umbrella.
Excellent. And Mike, we're doing a TV show podcast?
Yeah, we're doing a TV series on HBO called Lovecraft Country. So the podcast is appropriately titled The Travel Guide to Lovecraft Country. I'm curious. I have a feeling the opinions on the show might be a little out of step with some of the rest of the critics of it. I know at least one person on the show seems to really particularly despise a lot of the stuff in it, and other opinions kind of range. But it does give us, I think, some interesting conversation. So we are doing that, recording it every typically Monday or Tuesday, and so usually drops on like Wednesday or Thursday. So if you're interested in that, and if you watch Lovecraft Country, currently 5 episodes now available on the Hobo channel, HBO, then, you know, please check us out on your iTunes, Stitcher, and every place else that the internet is sold.
Excellent. And Chrissy, you do things?
I do. I write a lot of short fiction. I edit a literary magazine, and our second issue is coming out soon. And you can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
Excellent. All right. And we'll worry about the book episode later, Abe, since that's somewhere in the future. We won't bother talking
somewhere
about that now.
Somewhere
in the book, in the book,
sure.
In the book, the book, in the book, in the book.
Yeah, it'll be after the Lovecraft season is over. But anyway, let's get our final thoughts on this film. So let's start with you, Abe.
So while I wasn't absolutely blown away by this movie, I didn't think it was absolutely anything spectacular. I don't think it deserves some of the body slams it's getting from critics and some viewers. It isn't exactly something I would tell people to go rush into rents. Maybe if you had a stream service that was you're already paying for it and it was on selection, so you're going to just buy to watch that one, then maybe give it a shot. It's not a straight up horror movie. It's more of a psychological mystery with some supernatural elements here and there. I thought the performances were good. There are some cool shots, and there's some cool, nice little bits of a little humor sprinkled here and there. It's a decent watch. And if you are still interested after hearing our initial thoughts or after listening to this and you still want to check it out, then go right ahead. If not, then you can I'm sure I'll be still around and you can put it in the back burner of your watch list if you want to, you know, kind of think on it. But overall, not a terrible film, but I still enjoy these discussion, and that's what my thoughts.
All right, very good. What about you, Mike?
Yeah, again, this is not a film that is the sort of film I enjoy a lot, so take everything I say with that in mind. And again, also take in mind that I was really exhausted when I was watching it, so I may not be giving it its proper due. Like I said, a lot of the elements are really good. Again, the direction was pretty tight. The visuals were nice, although those particular the visuals, the spatial distortion stuff for me a little bit goes a long way, and there was a lot of it here, and I tend to find that a little tedious, and it doesn't. I don't get wowed by it, I guess, as easily by some of these things. It's just not my cup of tea. And I found the story predictable. But the characters are, like I said, the characters are well-drawn, and the atmosphere is fine. So, again, Netflix watch or Shutter watch or Prime watch or any or Tubi or whatever that you can, that would be my recommendation.
Fuck Tubi.
What's wrong with Tubi, Eric?
I don't know. I have an irrational hatred of Tubi.
Sure. Yeah, that's
okay. Eric, show me on this podcast where it touched you.
I forgot it last. Tubi or not, either way,
Tubi.
Fair enough, Mike. Let's go with you, Chrissy.
Tubi or not Tubi. That's really funny.
I did really like this movie. For me, it was fresh. It was different. I think it, you know, it wasn't as predictable to me as it was to the others on this podcast. But that's because I probably just went into it having it come highly recommended to me. So I really wasn't, I was just along for the ride. And I didn't even make notes until the second time I watched it. So I literally was just sitting there with my brain turned off, just being entertained. And for me, that was, it was very, very enjoyable. So I highly recommend this. And I do recommend it, especially if you're like me and you're a haunted house film junkie or a ghost story junkie, because it's just, when you compare it to most of the haunted house movies that are out there, this is kind of like that movie, The Room, that we covered earlier this year that was on Shudder. It was just different. It just did something a little bit different. And so I'm going to give this one a high recommend.
All right. Okay, sounds good. For me, yeah, I would highly recommend it too. I mean, I thought it was a really solid ghost story, and I think it, or haunted house story. I think it was better in a sense than the usual, for the fact that it had the maze type stuff that was going on and the mystery, and that it really wasn't a ghost haunted house. It was something else. And whatnot, and the cool things you see in the trailer, if you follow the trailers, they actually are cool in the movie as well. So yeah, I mean, as long as you can get into the characters and the sub stories that are creating the dissension within their lives, then this is a high recommend, I think, and it was well done. Screenplay, I think some folks have said it was so-so, but yeah, the acting's great, the directing, the special effects, the editing, cinematography, it's all solid stuff. Eric?
This movie's decent. Catch it on streaming.
Okay, except Tubi.
Except Tubi. Fuck Tubi.
just probably because of the name.
Bob. So Eric rules on not to be.
Not to be.
Oh, jeez. All right. So, once again, this is a 2020 film, Blumhouse / Universal. It's called, basically, You Should Have Left, directed and written by David Cope, who's written a lot of big films in Hollywood. He also, is, like you said, worked with Kevin Bacon prior in Stir of Echoes. It's based off a novel called by Daniel Kehlmann, Kehlmann, originally in the German language, but translated to English, so you can read it if you want. This film, once again, stars Kevin Bacon and Amanda Seyfried, and they are able to show their acting chops and so forth. So, available anywhere VOD is found, and the disc is, if not out yet, it'll be there. So, with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in. Let's talk about You Should Have Left. Come back next week. We'll have another topic. Should I stay or should I go?
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. If I stay, it will be double. So come on, let me know. Should I stay or should I go? This indecision's bugging me. If you don't want me to set me free, exactly who am I supposed to be? Don't you know which clothes even fit me? Come on, let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow? Should I go?